a second here.
Yep, we are live now on Facebook.
Oh, we're live. Oh, cool. We're live again.
We are live again.
Oh, so, and we're recording too. How are you doing this morning, Diane?
I'm good, Chris. How are you? I feel kind of lonely here today. We're missing people.
We are indeed. It's been fun to have this series of 7 episodes where we've had guests. And I think we've learned a lot. I think it was different from our previous episodes, if you will, from late last year to June or so, mm-hmm. right, where it was just the two of us. And I think it was great to get some other perspectives.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. And, you know, so for those people that don't know what we did, we have just finished a 7 series, mini series, I guess, podcast on the new Massachusetts child support guidelines. And what we learned in our first episode way back, beginning of October, when we had Fern Frohlin with us. She's an attorney who has been on many task forces for the child support guidelines, is that we learned that it's federally mandated that every state has to review their guidelines every 4 years. So something new, I knew we had to review them, but I didn't realize it was a federal mandate.
I think if it wasn't a federal mandate, people might not do it. You know, it's this kind of stuff.
That's quite true. And so Fern was saying that it doesn't mean you actually have to change your guidelines, but you have to review them every 4 years. But this year, Chris, we had some major changes, didn't we?
I think we did. I think we, it seems that every time that it goes around, there is going to be some changes. And the nature of the beast with the child support guidelines and any kind of system like that is that it is not going to be perfect. And as soon as it starts being implemented, then we figure out what the warts are.
Right.
This time around, we've had some major changes, though, is that we've had some increases in the amounts the amount of child support that gets paid from the payor to the recipient. And there are a number of factors that go around that, and I think we'll review that in a bit. We've had some minor change in terms of the incomes being considered. Minor change, I'm saying, because it was just a tweak, I think, mm-hmm. right? That was reflecting a practice of what had been done previously, right? And then after that, we covered a number of issues with respect to the various sub-subjects, if you will, of child support.
Right. And we could have gone on for a lot longer.
I think we may have missed a couple of these topics, and we'll do our best to catch up on them at the next possible opportunity. But I think at this point, we've got a pretty good series of 7 plus 1 now, that's 8 episodes on child support, and that it should be something that should be useful to the public.
Yeah.
Before we go into this, I'm sorry. So we need to welcome our people here.
I know.
We just jumped right into it.
Right. And I didn't do my TGIDF.
Oh, goodness gracious. How could you not do that?
I don't know. So everybody, TGIDF, that is, thank goodness it's Divorce Friday. And here we are on Friday, November 19th and Thanksgiving. So it's right around the corner. So thank goodness it's Thanksgiving.
Thank goodness it's Thanksgiving. And so thank you for joining Divorce Friday. It is the podcast that addresses your financial questions about divorce. We have a website. It's called divorcefriday.com. We are just, I think, in the process of dispersing is not the right word, of publishing, if you will, the podcast episodes on the various podcast services out there. We are, I think, on Google, on Pandora, on Spotify, and I think we might be on a couple others that I can't remember at this point.
Yeah, well, we're getting there.
We're getting there. You can also find us on Facebook, and obviously, if you're watching this, you're watching it on Facebook right now. And if you are watching us on Facebook, please like the page, follow us. If you have found us on Twitter, please like the Twitter account also. Right? You can reach either of us at divorcefriday@gmail.com. The email gets to both of us, and we'll respond as soon as we can to your questions.
Right. And who are you, Chris?
Who am I? Oh, you mean you don't know yet? It's been a few years, you know, you should know by now. So I'm Chris Chen. I'm a certified financial planner and a CDFA certified divorce financial analyst in Newton, Mass. And you are?
And I am Diane Pappas, and I'm also a certified divorce financial analyst and a certified Quadro specialist. And my business is in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
A certified Quadro specialist. That's pretty, sounds pretty fancy. We have, in fact, done an episode last spring on Quadros. Yes. And if anyone there has questions about Quadro, obviously you're the person they should call.
Yep.
And so if you write to divorcefriday@gmail.com and it is a Quadro question, I am not going to answer it, Diane.
Sounds good. Should we just jump right in?
Let's jump right in. I think one of the major things that I have found from this update to the guidelines, to the child support guidelines, is the increase in payments that are being mandated by the guidelines. And it was sort of a surprise to me because, as you know, the previous set of guidelines, I think that came in 2017, was mandating the reverse. It was sort of a decrease in child support payments. Right. And I lost my train of thought there. I think there was a dog that is trying to interrupt me. And so it was a decrease. And I think there was a movement at the time to try to reduce payments overall, from the higher earners to the lower earners, not just for child support, but also for alimony. And it seems that at least when it comes to child support, there has been a bit of a turn with coming with these guidelines.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons that Fern Froelen in our first episode mentioned as to why the amounts went up is for a very obvious reason. We have one of the highest costs to raise children here in Massachusetts in the Northeast. And Massachusetts has the highest childcare costs in the United States, where one child, an infant, because that's the most expensive to have in daycare, is $355 a week. That is the average for one child. And that is the highest. And when the task force reviewed all this, they looked at 9 other states in the area that were surrounding Massachusetts, 4 states that are similar to Massachusetts, like California. And that is how they came up with the new numbers. Right. The other thing about that income change is that it hadn't been done since 2009. So it really wasn't even keeping up with inflation.
Right. And in fact, it's sort of an interesting point that you bring up there, right, is that the task force work is based on an economic review. Mm-hmm. of the situation. We haven't been able to get the people who've authored that review to come and talk to us, but we don't lose hope. We're still working on this. And the review is available, the economic review is available on the state website, if you're curious about that. But what they do is that essentially they go out and they figure out sort of what is the economic reality of parents having children. And that is what part of what the task force base itself when it sets these new standards every 4 years. Right. It's a difficult job, actually, because obviously you mentioned that it is an average 355, mm-hmm. and it can vary quite a bit. It can be not often, but sometimes a little bit less, and more often a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that's important to realize that was emphasized in these new guidelines, but that have been in the other ones, but maybe not to the same extent, is that all parties have an obligation to support their children. Mm-hmm. So I think the restructuring of these these the guidelines and the amount is to take into account that both parties do have an obligation to support their children. And it just takes into account the parents' share of the cost of those expenses, right, which we had in the past, but not to the same extent, especially with childcare and the new guidelines. That was a major, I think, a new thing that was in the child support worksheet, was the way that they are calculating the childcare for kids that, you know, that are in childcare age.
Right, exactly. So we've mentioned a little bit about how the child support payments are changing, and it doesn't really change uniformly across all cases. It seems that it increases most for people who are higher earners, and for people who have more children to consider.
Yeah. Well, just as an example, Chris, so I have a case that we started back in April. So when we ran the child support guidelines, we obviously did not have the new ones. And now we have to rerun them because they haven't gone to court yet. So when we go to court, we have to use the new guidelines. So based on using the same income that we had back in April as we have now, the child support payment went, this is for the father paying to the mother, it went from $505 a week, and running it in the new guidelines increased it to $603 a week using the exact same numbers. So that was a 19% increase in the alimony payment from $505 to $603. So almost about $100 a week.
What incomes were used?
So the incomes were on the lower side. The husband was around 120, and the wife was working part time, so she was under 10,000. Mm-hmm. So she had much lower income. So that is important, because you know, if we did it at the higher end, it would probably be a little different.
Right. So clearly, it's potentially a big issue. Because obviously money is usually short, and in a divorce, money is even shorter. Like you were saying, it's an obligation, though, of parents to support their children. And that is what the child support guidelines are about. But I think it's clear that it may create some financial discomfort on the part of the payor, mm-hmm. at the same time that it provides somewhat of a relief to the recipients.
Yeah. So in this case, the father got a raise. So we have to use the new income. So I just out of my own curiosity, I just ran with the same income that we were already using in the other child support guidelines. With his new income, that just went up a couple, you know, it wasn't a significant increase. It was, you know, basically a raise. The new payment went up to 619. So it went from 505. And if we had used the same income, it would have gone to 603. And now at the new income, it went up to 619. So the father sends me an email, why did it go up? I said, well, that's
because. Yes, and I think we understand that. It's hard, right?
But he didn't know that, because even though I did explain that, you know, we have new child support guidelines coming out, I don't think people really understand that means it's going to most likely increase your child support payment.
Right. I mean, it would change at the very least, but in this year, it went up, right?
So, yeah. Yep.
And I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that it is going to be difficult for some people.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And we went into that in one of our later episodes when child support is not enough. But child support is always an interesting topic. The other thing that the increase from the income from 250 to 400 was huge. So that, again, for people that don't understand what that is, there's a benchmark as to income that is carved out or reserved, so to say, for child support. And then the rest would be for something else, maybe additional child support or even alimony. So there's always a benchmark. And it used to be in Massachusetts that gross income up to 250 would be reserved for child support, although we could also have done alimony too, but we have a little more guidance on that now. But
I think you mentioned that, I think it's important to mention that it is $250,000 in joint income.
Yeah, joint.
For both parents. Yep. And you mentioned a case of a mom that, isn't making, that wasn't making much money. But in many cases, there is more of a regular income, if you will.
So, right. Well, and the reason why they raised it to 400. So now the new benchmark, or the, you know, the limit, income limit, is 400,000. And what that does is takes into account the higher incomes that we have, especially here in the Northeast. The income of 250 hadn't been changed since 2009. So that's when I got divorced. So that's a long time ago mm-hmm. that the income hadn't reflected, like I said, even the inflation. If inflation was run on that 250, we would be up around 315 right now. So going up to the cap of 400 really wasn't a big surprise. It was warranted. And that's, I think, one of the biggest things that creates some problems for people. Just more questions, now what do we do with the income? Is it all child support? Is there alimony? So there's all kinds of questions now.
I think it was always an issue in the past about what happens to the income that is above 250,000. And then obviously for the people who had the income, they were saying, well, nothing. And so it was distributed sometimes in terms of alimony and sometimes in terms of more child support. The thing that is interesting here is even though 400,000 is not terribly uncommon as an income, as a joint income in our state, it's still not everyone who gets that much money, right? No. And so effectively what it does is that unless we change things, it sort of eliminates alimony for the people who are making between 250 and 400. Right now, we had some different opinions on that. I think that Fern in particular was saying that there would be a potential opportunity here to calculate alimony first and then child support.
Well, I think one thing that she said that really stuck out to me was she said the assumption that a spouse has to take the leftovers as alimony is a mistake. That mm-hmm. is never what they meant. And what that means is, like you just said, does up to 400 now eliminate alimony? And what Fern was saying is that was never the situation. They said you always had an opportunity to calculate alimony first. But in previous years, I think people just kind of got lazy and they did the child support. And then they're like, oh, whatever's left over, we'll figure out what to do with it. And according to Fern, that was never supposed to be the case of the guidelines.
Right. And I think the intent of suggesting that there should be other ways to calculate child support than the standard way, I think it's nice, but I think that intent was already there at the last go around.
Yeah, I mean, it was.
Yep. And it's for a while, you, I, and all of our legal colleagues there were running around trying to figure out how to make that work, and it wasn't.
Well, now I think we have some very good guidance. And I'm sure you've been into some meetings with other professionals and that's what they're saying. And as Fern told us, we should come prepared with different calculations to see what is, the most economically fair to the parties. So whether that's calculating alimony first and then child support and then alimony, and the judges supposedly will be looking for reports, kind of what they say, tax reports, but that's really just reports showing the tax effect, and we should be ready to prepare to provide those reports to the judge and to the clients and to the attorneys.
So call me a little bit skeptical here. I think that reality, as we know very well, is that divorce is usually a little bit contentious. Mm-hmm. And when it is contentious like that, the impulse after a while is going to be, okay, so how do we get to a resolution faster? right? And how do we get to a resolution faster is to not make things more complicated than they absolutely need to be. Right? And that means that even though there is an intent now to provide more analysis for the judges, I'm not sure that this is going to last. I mean, last time around, as you remember, you're the one who pointed it out to me, is Paula Carey, who was the Chief Justice at the time, was saying, oh, this is going to be a great day for financial planners. And we're saying, oh, yeah, finally. Mm-hmm. Did it happen?
No. Well, that was the Alimony Reform Act. Yes. And that's when she said, you know, yes, I remember her standing up there in front of that meeting. And she said, oh, this is going to be great because now we're going to need those financial reports. Like, yep. And it never happened, really. Well, I'm determined to make it happen this time.
Yeah. So I'll make sure that I will petition Charlie Baker to appoint you to the court. Judge Pappas.
Yep, there you go. But, you know, really, when you come down to it, Chris, you know that a skilled CDFA such as ourselves can provide that kind of analysis fairly easily. And, you know, that the idea is if parties can agree on an income, I think that's the most important thing, what income to use. If the parties can agree to that, then running the different scenarios really doesn't take much time when you think about the whole scheme of things, you know, and how much money we're talking about.
Not to mention that it doesn't take that much time, but it provides an immense amount of value.
Exactly.
That I think that if someone who is going through divorce and is not availing themselves of that analysis, they're probably not doing themselves a favor. Right. I mean, not always. Sometimes it is simple enough that you don't need to do the analysis, I suppose. But
right. But another thing is that attorneys, I think, might still don't really understand what CDFAs do. And so they'll say, oh, we need a CPA. Well, just to, you know, as an FYI out there for people listening, CDFAs can do these types of tax analysis and reports as well. And it's all in the context of divorce. So it's, you know, to me, it makes sense to go that route.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so anyway, so good stuff. One of the things that you started addressing here was the issue of how is income figured. It's important because income is a basis upon which child support guidelines and, for that matter, alimony are applied. Right. And so we had an entire episode reviewing the income, reviewing how income is determined. One of the things that still strikes me as after years of working on this kind of stuff is how the child support guidelines have a list of income that should be considered. And it's a very long list. I think it's 29 or 30.
Yep, it's 30 now. It was 29, it's now 30, yep.
So it's 29 items. And and you look at these things and you say, wow, I didn't know that you could have income coming in so many different ways. And then they have number 30, which is other. Everything else, right? So so basically the point is that every income, all income that you have is at least potentially subject to being used for calculation of child support.
Right. And, you know, when we get into self-employed businesses, people will say, well, I don't actually get that money. It's like, well, but that's what's on your tax returns. And, you know, so it does create a lot of problems. But I liked what David Kellum, he was our speaker for that.
He's our income guy.
Yep, he was our income guy. And I liked, he put it kind of simply in one thing. He said, is this income available to the payor? You know, that's the biggest question. Is the income actually there? And in some cases, the client might say, no, it's not. But when you dig deeper, you realize, yes, that income is actually available. I think one of the examples we were talking about, which comes up a lot, is when you have your employer giving you 401k money, you know, contributing to your 401k. Essentially, they're providing you with money, but it's deferred money. And so the point is, can that employer contribution be used for child support? Well, in reality, that doesn't really go into your pocket right now. So it doesn't right now. Don't give me that face.
So I understand.
It goes into your pocket later.
It doesn't go into your pocket later, but it is income. Even though it is income that is not taxed currently, it is income that is tax deferred, right? And it is income. I'm sorry to say, it is income.
It is income, but it's not available for child support. If you're going to give somebody an amount to pay based on an income that they don't have, that's going to be difficult for them to, if they're not actually getting that in their pay stub and depositing it into their checking account. So you're obligating them for a payment where the money doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. And that's I've had the discussion about that with a number of lawyers who agree that it is income after being reminded that it should be income.
Yeah.
And that say, but no one considers it, but I believe that it should be considered as income. I really do. Now, the reality is that it's difficult, right? Because it is one more, an additional hurdle that you have to go through to get to an agreement. And if you can avoid having senseless arguments in the process of getting a settlement, then you should. And I think this particular item is going to be too difficult for people to get over in most cases.
Right. Yep. You see right here that Chris and I might not agree on something.
And so if you think that employer contributions to 401k should be income, you should talk to me. If you don't, then you should talk to Diane.
Well, I agree it's income. I'm not saying it's not income. I agree that it is your employer is giving you money. It is income, but it's treated differently and you do not have access to it right at this time. Now, the way we handle that income that the employer has been giving you year after year is that we divide the 401k, and therefore you are getting a piece of that income. You're just getting it in a different way. You're getting it by dividing the 401k.
No, but that's an asset already.
Yes, but it's that the money went in there. So
if you're dividing last year's contribution to the 401k, it's an asset. So the challenge, I think, for what you're saying is that this year's, say next year's contribution to the 401k are income, but they are more difficult to use to figure out what a child support or alimony calculation should be.
I think in the end, there are valid arguments for both. Mm-hmm. And, that's unfortunately the way it is in divorce. There are two sides to everything, and it's just how easily one can support it, I suppose. So
one of the incomes that is not very well treated in the child support guidelines is variable income.
Yeah.
So many people have variable income, and what I mean by that is that it is not like a fixed salary that comes on your paycheck every pay period. It's variable income, such as bonuses, commissions, things like that, executive comp, like stock options and RSUs and so on. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the guidelines don't treat that very well.
No, they don't go into a lot of detail. So we did have, was that David that spoke to that? Averaging. And, that's just when it does make up a big portion of a base salary. So I think there are two different kinds of variable income. There are people who have a base salary that we do know. And then there are those with the base salary, then they get maybe a huge bonus or commissions on top of that. Then there are people who don't have any base salary. It's just their income is commission. And it just varies from year to year, month to month, week to week.
Sure. And that's, it's actually very difficult to deal with because the way that child support is paid is that it is paid on a fixed amount on a regular basis. And so it's hard to use that variable income to do child support, but it can be done.
Yeah, it can be done. And that's what I was saying in the beginning. I think the first step with child support, when there's anything other than just a simple W-2 income, is to try to get an agreement as to what to use as for income first, because everything else, alimony, child support, is dependent on that income. So if you don't have an agreement on it, and that's sometimes what goes back and forth, is agreeing on someone's income, especially business income, and someone who owns their own business.
I was reviewing some of the guidelines after talked to our guests in the past 7 weeks. Past 7 to 8 weeks. And One of the things I noticed is that we forgot to talk about income that is not always included. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you have a second job at the time that you divorce, that income will be counted towards child support guidelines, right? So if you get don't have a second job before divorce, but you get one after divorce, that second job income is not counted.
Correct.
Right. And there are a few other elements like that, which sort of breaks the rules that everything must be counted.
Right. Well, you know what? I also have here the argument that, well, you know, now the wife is living on her own and she's got a roommate. You know, there's like she's renting a room out in her house. And is that considered income after the fact? You know, they didn't have a roommate during the marriage, but because money's tight, she needs to bring in some extra money. So maybe they're renting out the basement or something like that.
I would think of it more as a reduction in expenses. But yes, I could see why people would like to think of it as income.
Yeah, and the spouse who's paying the child support will always bring that up, you know, in a modification. So, you know, and that for a time there, I think people were using that income for child support or alimony purposes. So I don't know if that's been addressed in this one, in these guidelines.
I can't remember for sure whether it has or not. I think that it is arguable though that it is not income, that it is a reduction in expense, and maybe that is just semantics. The reality is that it's difficult to it's difficult to live on less income, right? And that's what we're trying to address here.
Right. And it wouldn't be fair to use that income against the person who's getting it, because then that person never has an opportunity to advance. Mm-hmm. If we're always going to keep clawing back at income and not giving them the ability to advance their, you know, their station or their lifestyle, it's going to beat them down after a while.
Yes, it is. Yeah. So another set of income that wasn't terribly that is not terribly well addressed in the guidelines is executive comp. Mm-hmm. And so these are things such as RSUs or stock options that many people in the tech industry and the biotech industry get. And however, the money that you realize from it is not necessarily something that happens on an annual or definitely not a monthly basis, right? So it is something that often happens after a while, right? Mm-hmm. And so some of these incomes, some of these type of executive comp in my mind are clearly income. For instance, non-qualified restricted stocks are incomes, because when they vest, they actually count as income on your W-2. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's definite proof that it is income. Yeah. Some of the others are harder. Like, so for instance, with stock options, mm-hmm. right? Is that stock options, you have 10 years to exercise them. So if you haven't exercised them, then is it income?
Not right now, but it could be in the future.
It could be in the future, right? So if it is vested, then it is, if it is a stock option that is vested but not exercised, is that income?
Not yet.
Yeah. So that's, I think, going to your point that the parties should, if they can, agree to what is income ahead of time at the beginning of their negotiations, so that they can come to a smoother end of the year.
Right. So for example, in the agreement, if there were options that were not exercised and they have 10 years to do so, there would be maybe a clause or some language in the agreement that would say, you know, the options granted X, Y, and Z would be spelled out. You know, if they are exercised by a certain period of time, they would be considered as income for purposes of child support or alimony or whatever. So as the point is that everybody needs to be aware of this type of income and not.
What happens also is that it's certainly not for everyone, but for many people, especially when it is in the startup industry like biotech or tech, mm-hmm. right, is when you get these kind of options and they're significant, you're likely to be to have income that is over $400,000,
right,
like joint income, right? And when that happens, then there is, you know, it might be the thing to do to work at it, to work on that excess income is something different than child support. And I'm not saying it is necessarily the case every time, but it might be the thing to do to say, okay, so that income will count it as alimony, yeah, or a subject to alimony, and then not touch the child support any further.
Right, right. And also, we need to also point out that if the options or RSUs, which are restricted stock units, if those have already been divided as assets, then any future income from them is excluded. These would be things that are earned after the date of divorce that were not divided already as an asset, because you can't double dip.
Right. So double dip is sort of an interesting thing to bring up, right? Is that double dip means that the income that is subject to either or child support or alimony or both cannot be counted for both. Right. Can only be counted for one of them.
Right.
Right. Yep. Okay. We also talked during this 7 to 8 weeks about income for business owners. Mm-hmm. The great advantage in a divorce situation of someone earning a paycheck is that income is a lot easier to determine. For business owners, it's complicated.
It can be very, very complicated, as our conversation with Dave Consigli told us, right? All the different nuances that we have to look for when someone is self-employed and owns their own business. So I think we were talking a lot of times what happens is that people tend to run a lot of their personal expenses through their business, thereby reducing their taxable income. Some of these expenses you're allowed to, and some are not. But the point is that in divorce, we are allowed to look at those expenses and possibly add them back in, thereby increasing the party's income.
So I think there's a number of income that is, a number of businesses that are possible in this situation. Let me see if we can take one set of income and set it aside. It's reasonably common for people to have rental property. Mm-hmm. So rental property is essentially income. Right. It's essentially a business income, sorry. And then you have the income of people who work and file a Schedule C. They're basically solo operators. They are freelancers, or they have a business where there is no other not much other people complexity, right? And so those are treated on a Schedule C usually, and then you have people who have more complex businesses that are in a regular corporation or a more extensive kind of a partnership, and where you have a greater trouble trying to figure out what the expenses are. And of these expenses, what are the expenses that are legitimate from a business standpoint, and what are these expenses can be counted as income?
Right. So just to put it simply, right, I am a sole proprietor. I file my income on a Schedule C. So let's just say I'm the one that was going to have to pay child support. And when someone goes to look, what's that?
Perish the thought.
Well, it happens. And so let's say we're going to look at my Schedule C, and I have expenses on there. So I've got things like I went to a conference. Okay, that's fine. Go to a conference. I maybe sometimes take people out to entertain them, you know, for whatever reason, maybe other attorneys that I want to work with. I have my fees for my computer programs and my licenses and things like that. But then all of a sudden someone sees, oh, wait, what is this car payment in here? And, oh, what is this miscellaneous $5,000 a year? That was a vacation. So when we start looking at those and saying, well, wait a minute, what we have to look at, is that an expense necessary to run the business? And they would say, Diane, no, that really, you were not supposed to take that $5,000 deduction for your vacation. Therefore, we're going to add that back to your income.
Let's point out right away that number one, you don't do that.
Number one, I do not do that.
Number two, that the IRS frowns upon writing off vacations. They don't like it.
No.
And number three, that it does happen that people will put through their business P&L expenses that shouldn't be there.
Yeah, I mean, they pay for car cell phones for their kids. Sometimes they have, memberships at clubs and stuff. You know, I think during that conversation, I said, oh, what about somebody that has a box at Gillette Stadium? Can they run that expense to the business? And, is that expense needed to run the business? And then my response would be no.
That's your response. But I'll tell you that a lot of business gets done in these boxes.
Right. Well, we have to look at the type of business. And in the type of business that I'm talking about, it wasn't used in that respect.
I mean, like yours.
No, not mine. Not my business. But, you know, like you were saying, I went to one conference. Now, I think Dave Consigli brought this up when he said there was somebody who had when he was reviewing their tax returns and their business expenses, they had gone to 5 conferences. And that was kind of unusual. 5, I mean, I only go to a conference every other year because they are so expensive. So 5 conferences in 1 year. And then what Dave said, he said he would, in order to really understand whether that was a necessary expense, he would go around and see what other professionals in that same line of business were doing. Were they going to 5 or were they conferences, or were they only going to 1? And if it always came back that it was much less than 5, then there was an argument to say, well, this person is writing off too much. And
so, you know, honestly, I hear what he's saying, but I think he's really situationally dependent.
Yeah, that is.
There was a time. There was a time when I was going to 3 to 4 conferences a year, right? And that is when I was in sort of a greater learning phase.
Right. Yes, that too.
I was, right. Yep. And honestly, one of the benefits of the pandemic for me is that it cut my conference travel short. to the point where I'm looking at next year's conference and I'm saying, probably not.
Right. Yeah, so I think what you're bringing to light, Chris, is the fact that it's really a case-by-case basis, and it depends on the industry, it depends on the type of business, you know, and the history.
And so that being said, there are expenses that can often be taken back out of a P&L and put back into income. So you were mentioning a cell phone for the kids, right? So you're mentioning, what were you mentioning? I think that's the one thing that...
if there is such a thing, they're paying for their car, you know.
Sure.
College, I've heard of college tuition.
Yes, college tuition. And by the way, to write off college tuition for your kids through the P&L is not something that the IRS smiles upon.
No, not at all.
Please don't say that you've heard it. You've heard Diane and Chris say that it is okay. It is not.
It is not okay.
It is not. But so you have a lot of these expenses that can be brought back in as income. The more legitimate expense that can be brought back is depreciation.
Right.
But that's why I was mentioning earlier the real estate. Mm-hmm. And so on a real estate P&L, on a rental real estate P&L, you will almost always have depreciation on there. And that is a non-cash expense. And it is completely legal. However, for child support purposes, and in fact, alimony purposes, you can fish it back out and put it back into income.
Right. And thereby increasing the income for child support.
And thereby increasing income available for child support.
Available. Yep.
And so many businesses don't have a lot of depreciation. Like I don't think yours does or mine does. Yep. But I know of a recent case where I worked on where they had a semi-industrial company where they had a lot of equipment. And that gets depreciated, and therefore the depreciation can get fished back as income.
Right. I also had a tax return, or not a tax return, it was a profit and loss that I was reviewing. And again, this is something that you are not allowed to do. But this person was paying alimony, and putting it on a 1099 and paying it to his ex-wife through the business. And that is not something that you can do.
So I think perhaps we should tease out that we're planning to do an alimony series next year, next semester, if you will. We'll get back into a greater detail on that. But you can't do that. I mean, there are ways to pay alimony creatively, right? But what you mentioned just doesn't work.
No, that's not one of them. Right. We also had a conversation about what if child support's not enough?
Yes, unfortunately that happens, right?
Yeah. And, we had a conversation about it with attorney Deb Smith. The only way that we could come up with anything that made sense was to, because there's only two ways to make ends meet. And that is to bring in more income or reduce your expenses. Right. So, when child support is not enough, then the person who's receiving child support needs to consider furthering their education so that they can advance further in their careers. Maybe it's changing where you're living, moving. I think we use an example of someone living in Cambridge or something and having to move out maybe to the burbs to try to, save a little money there. There only is so much money that can go around in a divorce. And when it's not enough, that means there's something wrong. There's the expenses are too high.
The reality is that it's more expensive to live in two households than one. The Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that it is 25% more expensive to have two households instead of one. And so both parties are going to be strained at the expense level. Right. And I think that what you're saying makes total sense, though, is that people will have to reconsider what they consider essential.
Yeah.
And what used to be essential maybe prior to the divorce maybe is no longer essential.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people too think, why should I have to suffer? I'm not the one that wanted this divorce. Why am I the one that is getting put out and whatnot? And, that is a tough thing. I know that's what happens a lot of times with the emotions after divorce, but unfortunately you can't sit there and think about it that way. It's like, you really have to pull yourself up from your bootstraps, as they say, and figure out and be a strong person and not play the victim and say, all right, I got to figure this out for my kids and for me. I have to figure this out. What am I going to do?
A shameless plug for the kind of things that we do, Diane, is that it is one of the values of financial planners is that we can help you do that in a potentially more efficient way.
Right.
It's not that simple to go from one type of lifestyle to a different type of lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And it's not that simple to consider what the long-term consequences of everything is, mm-hmm. and how to essentially line up everything. Right. So it's something that we can help with, actually.
Yep. Yep. And a lot of our clients benefit from it, just knowing what it's going to look like, with the income they have, with the child support. And when they really do a deep dive into their expenses, which I help my clients with all the time, they'll get a much better idea and sense of what post-divorce life is going to look like. And I think sometimes just taking away that fear of the unknown also makes it better for people because they just don't know. They don't know what to expect. They've never gone through this situation before in their life. But if we can just shed some light on it to say, look, it's not going to be as bad as you think. And here are just the few things you need to do. And you know what? They're probably temporary until you just, a couple of years pass, you get back on your feet, things level out, your kids get older. Then you can start adding things back in,
And it's also not just about deprivation. It's not necessarily deprivation. It's really about identifying the expenses that are important to the, and differentiating them from the expenses that maybe, are not that important. Well, and those expenses that are not important are the expenses that don't bring you that much value that you do maybe automatically.
Right.
People like us often bring up the Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks habit.
Yep, and Whole Foods. Yep.
And Whole Foods. And so I used to have a Starbucks habit. It was a twice a day Starbucks habit.
Oh.
And the pandemic definitely broke the back off that one.
And now you've got more money in your pocket, right?
Well, you know, it's the simple fact is that it was a habit. It wasn't something that I needed to do for anything. And that's, I think, the same thing that happens for a lot of people is that we spend money on things that we don't even remember that we spent money on, you know?
Right. Yep. No, agreed.
Right. One of the things that you brought up there, so we said, what if it is not enough? So you mentioned about, getting some additional training for future for a different career or something like that. This is something that actually I believe in a lot. Mm-hmm. I've had several clients over the years who've done that, and kudos to them. And it's all kinds of things that are possible, right? So the examples that I used when Debbie Smith was here was someone who went back to school to become a nurse practitioner, mm-hmm. right? Someone who went back to school to get a master's in engineering. And someone else who went to for a certificate in radiology, right? These all kinds of things that are qualify you for a job that you didn't qualify for before, and that enable you then to get back on having a regular income, a stable income with benefits.
Yep. Well, as you know, Chris, I was a stay-at-home mom for 18 years. And after my divorce, I had to decide what I was going to do. And look where I am now.
Yeah, so you took sort of a different route there, is that you plunged into the deep end of the pool.
I did. Yep, I wasn't afraid.
And then you essentially you learned how to become self-employed. And mm-hmm. and that is, congratulations to you for doing that. It's not easy, right? And it is possible, though. And I would encourage everyone who is looking to do this kind of stuff, right, to look at it as a business.
Yeah.
Right? Because the example that I bring a lot is that when you look at real estate offices around the state, around the country, right? You often have dozens of people who are listed as agents there. And in most of these offices, there's maybe five or six people that make any money.
Right.
Right. The other, the rest of them are not taking it seriously as a business. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's, something that needs to be done for success.
Yeah.
So how about expenses not covered by child support? Because not everything is covered by child support.
Right.
That's, I think there is a disagreement. I think where child support is supposed to cover basic expenses, and mm-hmm. there is not always agreement as to what the basic expenses are. I think we agree on food.
Yep.
We agree on shelter.
Yes.
We agree on clothing.
Yes.
And I think after that, agreement sort of breaks down.
Yeah, that's what the definition is, clothing, food, and shelter. And anything over that has to be shared somehow between the parties. And I liked what Teresa Reed said. That was when attorney Teresa Reed joined us from Peabody. She said, what was the history in the family of having that type of expense? Something that's not covered by child support, because sometimes after, when a divorce happens or when a parent separate, all of a sudden they start putting their kids into all these expensive summer programs and things, and which didn't happen during the marriage, but all of a sudden now it is happening. And so the question is, do these expenses, can they continue, and who should pay for them after the divorce? And I think going back to the history and looking at, is this a common occurrence in the family? If it is, then we need to figure out, does it continue? And we need to figure out how we're going to share that in those expenses, the cost for those expenses.
So one of the big expenses, so we talked about these expenses cover all kinds of stuff, such as I think we mentioned orthodontics, mm-hmm. We mentioned summer camps and things like that. But it also covers the biggie, right? It's college.
Yep.
Right. So college is a biggie. These days, if you're going to pay full price at a top private college in the Northeast, it's going to cost you $300K over 4 years, not per year.
Almost.
It's getting there.
Getting there.
Right. And so, you know, if you have a couple of kids or something, or two or three kids, it's potentially the largest expense to be divided from divorce, or at least one of the top few. And it's usually not addressed very well in divorce agreements.
Nope. A lot of people, the famous word is, they're going to punt. You're going to punt it until the time arrives. And then as we know, Chris, that's the worst thing to do.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
To not address it at all, just to not even have some kind of caveat in the separation agreement that just gives you a path forward or some type of, starting ground from which to figure out how you're going to pay for college.
So the guidelines actually suggest a path forward.
Yeah, they actually do.
Well, they suggest elements of a path forward. Right. Mm-hmm. They suggest that we should use UMass Amherst, so here in Massachusetts, as the cost benchmark, right, for what college should cost, and that neither party should be obligated to pay more than half of the cost of UMass Amherst.
Right.
Right. And I find that, I don't know, I think that's sort of a cop-out in the sense that lots of people, many people are quite happy with UMass Amherst, but lots of people have different ambitions for their children, mm-hmm. and want them to go to the 300K colleges, which is well in excess of the cost of UMass Amherst. Mm-hmm. And it creates a problem when you punt, right? Because when you punt, that means that either party can say, nope, I'm not paying more than half of the cost of UMass Amherst. And who suffers out of that?
Well, the child, I suppose. We also, the parties, I'm going to play devil's advocate. The parties have to be realistic as to what they can really afford. And Chris, you and I have had this conversation before that when parents go through a divorce, they may feel guilty about what it's doing to the children. And so they say, well, we're going to send you to, you know, the most expensive school you want to go to, without having that realistic conversation with their kids to say, you know what, we really can't afford that.
Right. And it's a problem, I think, for people who are happily married or at least not divorcing, is that they will want to give the kids their dream school, right? And the dream school is not necessarily what's best for them.
No.
It is usually not what's best for the family's finances,
no. right?
And even for people who are not on the way to divorce, it's a difficult conversation, and it's even worse when people are on the way to divorce.
Right, and even worse when they're in litigation, because they don't even, at that point, they don't even care. They don't even want to talk about anything anymore.
Exactly. Well, when they're in litigation, they often don't talk, right? They let their lawyers do the talking, and I'm sorry to say to our friends who are lawyers, but that's not a productive way of dealing with a person's future, and I'm talking about the children.
No, nope, we've lost control at that point.
Right. So that was an interesting point that we brought up. And so the last item, I think, was what Kate Blake brought up last week with respect to interaction with alimony.
Right. Yeah, that's always a tough one. And so my question to her was, what makes an alimony case? You know, there's child support, but if there's income left over, do we calculate alimony first? But we have to go back to, is this an alimony case? And did we get an answer? Because I don't really, you know, I mean, there.
I don't think she was very specific on that. I think the basics of alimony is that it's based upon need and ability to pay, right? And so ability to pay has been, at least on paper, circumscribed to $400,000, right? And it's unclear, right? Because ability to pay basically As far as the transport guidelines say, is that basically it says as a first step is that the first $400,000 are used for child support. We mentioned earlier no double dipping, so the first $400,000 should not be used for alimony, right? And then we've had the contrary argument that was made that said that we should perhaps consider doing alimony first, right, and then child support. And so anyway, I. Needless to say, it's a bit confusing.
Right. And but it does boil down to, is this an alimony case? So that, you know, when you have two parties that are making substantial amount of income, you know, one's making 600, one's making 300, is that an alimony case? We ran that by several of our attorney friends and they said, no, most likely not.
Because at 300K, the person who's making 300K is not exhibiting a need.
No, they can live. You can live on 300K. You can live on 100K.
Whereas if someone is making 25K, then there is most likely a need.
Right. And when there's a big disparity in income levels, and we also have to look at those other factors in the case, the length of the marriage, you know, the health of the parties, the age of the parties, all those things go into determining whether or not it's an alimony case.
Right. So perhaps we should say at this point that we'll cover more alimony in January or February.
Yes, in our alimony series.
In our alimony series. And so I think that was a pretty interesting review of everything that we've talked about over the past 2 months or so. Mm-hmm. Right. And at this point, this is going to be our last live episode for the year.
Yep. For 2021.
We're off to enjoying Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I just want to say one thing, though, Chris. I went to a lot of discussions about the new child support guidelines. I'm sure you did, too. And I think we did a really good job of, you know, talking about all the different topics. And I think I think ours was almost better than some of these other ones that I went to, you know, that you have to pay for. So I think we did a really good job. And
I think we did that. I think it's a great service to the public too, because obviously it's not it's inexpensive. Yeah. And I think it's important for people, even when they have a lawyer, to get themselves educated on the topic so they can understand what their lawyer is talking about. Right?
Agreed. Well, we are at that time.
So we need, I guess, one more time to remind everyone that a podcast does not replace professional advice. If you are thinking of divorce or going through divorce, please seek the help of a professional. We cannot replace that over here.
That's right. Yeah, and we can hold your hand, but we can't do a whole lot.
Right. So we're not lawyers, right? But so obviously you and I will help on the financial aspects of whatever it is that we've been talking about. So we are coming back next year. And so we will publish one of our old episodes weekly and up until we come back next year. And next year we'll be talking about alimony, which should be another fun topic. We haven't quite figured out, I think, how or what or in what configuration, but I think we're looking forward to have some more guests to talk about that.
Yep, I think that's the best. I think that's the best way to go, especially with alimony, since alimony is a legal issue, but it has huge financial ramifications.
Totally. Okay, so at this point, it's time for your acronym.